Myths of mermaids, of people living below the sea, have swam through the mind of man since he first set sight upon the ocean. It's a place that's beautiful, complex, and filled with insane and incredible marine life that looks like it comes from an alien planet. So even without imaginative stories of krakens and island fish and sirens, the sea itself, as an environment so different from the land, holds an innate natural allure. The fields of marine biology and oceanography are vast and dense, and even without magic and enchantment, it's a pretty amazing thing to study. So, why I like to focus on mythology is because it has these universal elements of things that don't necessarily really exist, but they keep popping up in stories across the globe from people who haven't had contact with each other. So today, we're going to focus on legends of sirens, of merfolk, of sentient human-like beings who either want to entrance you or, I don't know, murder you, fall in love with you, tell your future. You never know with them, but the history and the stories that have arisen from this area of mythology are fascinating and so cool. So in each section of the world, through various lives, various times, tales of sirens, they've arisen from the depths continuously. So I wanted to discuss three different types of merfolk that aren't necessarily super popular. So this is going to be some more niche information. So we're going to start down in Japan with the Ningyo, way in the south, and then we'll move far up to the Arctic Sea and we'll look at the Nordic Finn folk, and then we'll travel over to more tropical waters by the equator called the Caribbean Sea, where we'll discuss the mermaid, kind of known as a Mami Wata. So we'll look at the influences that created mermaids in the Pirate of the Caribbean lore, more of the traditional mermaid that swims in the blue waters and falls in love with Captain Jack Sparrow. So before we go there, we're going to start in Japan with the creature called the Ningyo. Now, the Ningyo are fascinating characters because the island of Japan itself has more of an insulated history. It's fairly remote, and it's also shaped by the sea. So Japan has real-life sirens known as Ama, and these women are still around. They're actually pearl divers who delve deep into the sea to gather seaweed, shellfish, and of course pearls to trade back on land, and there's evidence of them doing this as far back as 2,000 years, but some people think it's a tradition that's been going on for even longer. So these women are incredible athletes, and they use breath-holding techniques that train their bodies to retain more oxygen so they don't have to breathe quite as much, right? It's like they create these saving banks of air that they can pull on as they dive deep into the depths. So one way they do this is by exhaling slightly before diving, and that expels excess carbon dioxide, and that kind of minimizes oxygen consumption. It cues your body to kind of go into hibernation mode in a weird way, prepping it for the lack of air as it goes down. So there's lots of breath holding techniques that you can actually find on YouTube and on the internet. Of course, do some research, be careful, but these are things that elite athletes have used. Divers still use them today. One of them is called lung packing, or a more like jargonized term would be glossopharyngeal insufflation, and that increases oxygen retention within your body. So the Ama's ability to hold their breath for extended periods underwater, it's a combination of these physical conditioning techniques that they employ, their mental focus, and a lot of training, right? Because this practice has been going on through generations and generations, and there's still some Ama in certain regions of Japan, but due to commercial fishing and kind of an evolving economy, it hasn't really retained as many members because it's not quite as necessary. But they are still there in some parts, and they're a living example of how the human body can be trained to do incredible things, very mermaid-like things. So stories of the Amma divers go back for these thousands of years, and they're highly respected in Japan as embodiments of perseverance, of strength, and of independence. And Japanese mermaid mythology undoubtedly took shape, in part at least, with inspiration from these real-life women. The Ningyo sirens were said to cry tears of pearls. So that kind of links the Ningyo to the actual pearl-diving women in Japan. And symbolically, the idea of crying pearls is a rather poetic idea. It speaks to, you know, this concept that a lot of the times beauty in life can result from things that are very sad or sorrowful. And it's illustrated in how these sirens would cry, and from their pain came something very precious in the pearl. And sometimes the worst things in life are blessings in disguise if you give them time. So in regards to the appearance of the Ningyo mermaid, they're a bit different than the classical Disney one, where she has, you know, a human-like upper body and she's beautiful and a very sleek tail. No, the Ningyo are much more predatory and strange and actually kind of frightening. Stories say that they had fish-like anatomies, pointed tails, and barbarous spines that protruded from their bumpy sea urchin-like skin. And when I painted these, I decided to give them more vibrant hues of blues and reds, which helps them to camouflage in the coral when they lie down and wait for their prey before striking out and grabbing them. So, yeah, if you want to see that artwork, that is up in the blog where I put a lot of the field notes where I conceptualize mythological creatures and then write about what stories people would tell about them as if they were real, like their lifespan, their diet, where they live, their size, etc., etc. So the Ningyo was a real joy to try and capture. And one less fascinating aspect before we leave Japan about the Ningyo sirens is that they had entrancing voices, which is not very strange for sirens. Oftentimes they're linked to singing, but these Ningyo sirens had prophetic songs. So it was thought that if you heard their tales, it would actually be indicative of future events, right? Which I just think is so wonderful. And not to get too far off topic, but the Banshee is a fairy up in Celtic mythology in Scotland and England. And when the Banshee would appear, she would be singing and washing clothes. And whenever anyone heard her song, it was a sign that somebody close to them was going to die. So the song of the Banshee had prophetic qualities as well as the Ningyo siren. And I do think that the water down here is getting a little bit chilly and strange, so let's go somewhere even colder and even stranger, far up north into the Arctic Circle. And so Viking mermaids are one of my favorites to talk about because the landscape is so strange and my family is Norwegian, so I kind of got to learn a little bit about the mythology from a part of the world where my ancestors lived for a while. And so up in the far north, in the darkest waters of the Arctic Ocean, there swims a species of mermaid that is both beautiful and wild. Because Scandinavia is geographically exposed to the ocean, the people living there had many interactions with the sea, and these interactions shaped their stories and their myths because it was their environment. The Nordic people's sea was cold, it was especially dangerous, and it was especially vast. It harbored whales and giant squid and narwhals and jellyfish and a bunch of strange things, alien sea creatures. And so I took these environmental elements, right, the size of the sea, the temperature of it, the creatures living in it, into account when I designed this Arctic mermaid who has more salmon-like scales and a layer of subcutaneous fat that would insulate her from the freezing water like you see in seals and in walruses and in other creatures living in very frigid temperatures. So the sirens of the north are sometimes referred to as the Finnfolk or the Finnar, and in a lot of Icelandic sagas that were written in the Middle Ages, the Finnar actually referred to a real group of people, but then it got twisted into meaning mermaids. So that term Finnar, it really depends on who's using it and when they're using it. So I think I'm going to refer to the Nordic mermaid as Finnfolk, as more of a umbrella term. But in Old Norse, Finnar means to find. And this is important because, like the Amma in Japan, inspiring the myth of the Ningyo, there were real people far up north who inspired the stories of the Finnfolk mermaids. So, because Finnar means to find, this was a term that Germanic peoples used to refer to a group of traveling nomadic humans called the Sami. So the Sami are fishermen and reindeer herders who live in the furthest northern stretches of what is now Norway, Sweden, Finland, and western Russia, a place called Lapland. And they have inhabited these northern regions for thousands of years, giving that extreme environment where, you know, you have the midnight sun, periods of extreme darkness, of extreme cold, time to shape their collective psychology into something quite unique and rather beautiful. I wanted to take a quote from a Roman historian that was written by a guy named Cornelius Tacitus in his work called Germania, where this is around 100 CE, where he provided one of the earliest written material about the Sami people that historians now have. He wrote about them, "Unconcerned towards men, unconcerned towards heaven, they have achieved a consummation very difficult. They have nothing even to ask for." And so, reading this, I think comparing the Sami people, who were, you know, nomadic hunter-gatherers, to a lot of other European cultures who by that time had kind of established city-states and different forms of more complex government, it shows how they could have been seen maybe as more animalistic, right? Because they didn't take things like taxes or social norms and societal aspects into account because they were so closely connected to the land, a lot like indigenous peoples over in North America. And so I like this last thing that he says, they have nothing even to ask for. I think that their disconnection from materialism, despite the harshness of their lifestyle, is rather fascinating. And without a doubt, there's something deeply valuable to be observed from the Sami's way of life, right? So the Germanic peoples, which included the Vikings, called the Sami the Finnar, because again, it means to find reindeer, to find life, to find things that you want to collect in order to survive. They were, they were travelers. So they saw the Finnar, the Vikings did, as a bit strange. And in an old world before cameras and planes, the mysterious nature of the Finnar people shifted slowly from reality to myth. And the Finnar likely helped spark legends of the Finnfolk, right? Hunting seals and following schools of fish, much like the Finnar did with reindeer. So the Nordic people blended the actuality of the Sami's nomadic lifestyle in the Arctic Circle with a tapestry of their own superstition regarding the other, eventually weaving a portrait of mythical beings with fins and gills who evolved from the depths of human imagination into the mermaids that we know today. So I wanted to include a shell mask on my illustration as a reference to how some mythologists believe that the stories of the Sami and the Finnfolk spread to inspire Selkie tales, because in Celtic lore, Selkies are the mermaids of a lot of traditional people in Scotland and England, and they are also called seal people. And they would wear seal skins upon their bodies when they walked inland, and then they would transform back into seals when they returned home to the sea. So the Sami people over in Nordic lands, they made their boats from animal skins, which would become waterlogged over time, and they would use other boat building techniques, but this was one of the more unique ones. And so when the skin became waterlogged, they would put it upon their backs, and that would help dry it out. It would help them move it around when they needed to switch locations. And that feat of wearing the skin could have later inspired some Celtic tales of Selkies or seal people, more remote nomadic groups who use natural products for their camouflage and also their hunting technology upon the sea. So perhaps the Finnfolk mermaids of the north, maybe they also wore shell masks. This is me kind of just being an artist and talking to the idea of what other technology mermaids could use. So perhaps they used the shell masks to become less threatening. They put them on their faces to look beautiful to humans they encountered, to perhaps, you know, trade with them. Or, you know, maybe it was an act of vanity. Perhaps mermaids would make masks in order to look a certain way in their society, because they're usually depicted with combs or mirrors, and they seem rather involved with their appearance. So why not make a shell mask? But yeah, that's more of kind of an artistic line of thought, not necessarily tied to historical mythology. So let's go ahead and leave the north, because I'm getting a bit lost in these waters and very cold and the sun's coming up. So let's talk about something more vibrant, something beautiful from the Caribbean Sea, which is wonderful because it's warm and there's lots of botanical life, and the weather doesn't change that much throughout the year. So lots of the plants and animals never leave because they have no reason to leave. And because of this, it seems as though a lot of places in the Caribbean Sea escape time in a strange way. So the Caribbean mermaid especially was challenging to categorize into one thing, because this sea has had so many influxes of people from around the world over the centuries, all of them bringing their own myths, blending tales from the past with the environment they found themselves in the present. So modern myths are composite creatures that embody the mixing of historical events, spiritual beliefs from different regions, and the actual physical biome in which people lived. So they're really, really cool summaries, right? Data points of what humanity has gone through. So I decided to name the Caribbean mermaid Aqua because she's a blend of so many different waters. And I've been collecting folklore more so in Jamaica, and that's one of the larger Caribbean islands, which has a population of African people who originally came from Ghana, Nigeria, and Central Africa. In these regions, a lot of people were part of the Yoruba tribe, whose gods and goddesses sailed over the sea with people who were part of the transatlantic slave trade, right? They brought with them not only seeds from plants that were grown in Africa, but also their ideas and their tales and their traditions. So the other culture that also influences the island of Jamaica and other islands in the Caribbean come from the Taino Indians, or the indigenous people. They came to Jamaica around 600 AD, which is long before European explorers got there and long before other people came due to the transatlantic slave trade of the 16th century. So you have these Taino people living here with their own stories, and then you also have Europeans and Africans coming along too. So let's examine who the Taino people thought mermaids were. They have this one story of one called Akaya. I might be mispronouncing that, but she was known for her beauty and her singing ability and her tendency to manipulate men. So there's some pretty hilarious folk tales of, you know, women really, really hating her and praying to their goddesses to murder her, and it gets very dramatic. A lot like Greek myth, actually. And then you have more African people coming into the Caribbean later on, and they brought a larger water deity known as the Mami Wata, which translates to Mother Water. And she was a grand, very, very large deity that existed in many places throughout Africa. So as soon as people separated and built up more unique cultures on the different islands, the umbrella term of Mami Wata began to take on more specific shapes depending upon where the story is told. So in Jamaica, you have someone called the River Mama, and she's a mermaid who guards a golden table in the rivers of Jamaica that was supposedly dropped by the Spanish conquistadors. And anyone who tries to go down into her lair and take away the table, she murders. You know, she kills you. So I don't recommend doing that. I think there's better ways to make money. But if you're an adventurous soul and you have experience pulling up heavy metals from the bottom of a body of water, maybe try it. But make sure you have a will before that, just in case. It's important to have these things in order. So the river mama, that is a more dangerous mermaid who lives in the Jamaican riverways, and she's absolutely fascinating to learn about. And again, her stories kind of have a bit of humor to them. So when I went to depict a mermaid that swims in the waters of the Caribbean Sea, I was a little bit confused, but I decided to make her a bit more golden and glittery in reference to that Spanish conquistador table and the idea of pirates and wealth and all of the economic trade and all of the stuff that went on down in this part of the world back in the day. So she's golden and she's a bit transparent. She shifts and she's half there and she's half somewhere else, kind of like myth, right? It's partly true and partly fictionalized embellishments. So I just had a great time painting her. And if you want to see any of these depictions of what the Japanese Ningyo look like, or the Nordic Fin Folk, or the Caribbean Aqua Mermaid, all of those are up, along with a written version of this podcast, on the Loreland blog and newsletter. All the links are down below. And I also put the source material too. So if you're curious about where I've gotten this information, you can follow links on there. And thank you so much for listening. Have a lovely rest of your day wherever you are, up on the land where humans play, and I hope you are able to swim off into the waters of myth. Bye.